Hey everybody, before we get started, I just wanted to jump on because we are so excited to announce that Restore registration is officially open. We can't wait to be with you again this year. It's going to be on September 5th through 7th at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. That's the evening of September 5th and then all day on the 6th and the 7th. 3 days of incredible speakers, poets, musicians, and artists. We really think that what we have planned will blow you away again this year, so you won't want to miss it. Go to faithmatters.org/restore for tickets and we'll see you there.
Hey everybody, this is Tim Chavez from Faith Matters. For this episode, Aubrey spoke with Richard and Linda Iyer about their book, The Turning, Why the State of the Family Matters and What the World Can Do About It. Richard's been on this podcast before, but this is the first time for Linda, and we were delighted to have her. Of the many topics that Richard and Linda have written and spoken about, it seems that there's none that they're more passionate about than the family. In particular, in this conversation, they spoke about why they believe that orienting your life toward your family has extraordinary benefits, both for individuals and society. They also shared very practical and fun ideas for developing and maintaining a strong family culture, and why it's important and how to avoid guilt as we inevitably notice our own inadequacies as we strive to live up to our family responsibilities. Richard and Linda are New York Times number one best-selling authors whose writing career has spanned 4 decades and whose books have sold in the millions. They've appeared on virtually all major national talk shows, including Oprah and The Today Show, and have seen their books translated into a dozen languages. They spend much of their time speaking to audiences throughout the world on families, parenting, and life balance, along with keeping up with their own 9 children and an ever-increasing number of grandchildren. We're excited to share this episode with you and hope that you enjoy this conversation with Linda and Richard Iyer.
All right. Well, we're really excited today. We have Richard and Linda Iyer joining us in the studio. So thank you so much for being here.
It's
welcome.
A delight to be here. Thank you. And I've heard you talk so much.
Oh.
And I'm so delighted to finally meet you and realize that you have 4 children in addition to all the stuff that you're doing. It's astonishing. Oh. It's really quite amazing. So I am thrilled.
See, it's kind of better having her here.
I like where this is going.
And I'm a thorn among the roses today. So.
Well, we are inspired by you too, and we're excited to get a more complete picture of your family and of the work you've done about family. So I'm excited to do this. To get started, I would love for you to sort of set the stage for us and talk about we're gonna spend a lot of time on families, but maybe to set the stage, you could talk about the church's emphasis on families and the way that it functions as scaffolding for that anchor.
Thank you, Aubrey. Let's do that. Let's set a context for LDS listeners. This is a quote by Harold B. Lee. The church is mere scaffolding with which we build eternal families. That's such a remarkable quote because it juxtapositions the temporary nature of the church, which is an earthly institution, a human institution inspired by God, contrasted with the family, which is an eternal institution. And by the way, I just think it's so important that I think it helps people experiencing a faith crisis to put those things in perspective. If we think the church is the end, the church is the measurement of everything, and whether you're active and whether you're a member and whether you do this and whether you do that is determines the success of your life, that puts too much pressure on the church. But if we think of the church as the means to an end, one of the many means to the end being exaltation, the end being eternal families, and we're told that over and over in scriptures. But if we think of the church as the end in itself, then people get very worried about something in history or the imperfection of a leader or whatever, and it begins to shake us. Whereas if we say, wait, the church is the scaffolding.
Yeah.
It's temporary. It's human. It's made up of ordinary humans. We shouldn't put so much pressure on the church to be perfect and to meet all our needs and to say all the things we need. It's just one of many means, a very, very important means to the end that is ours
right.
to pursue.
Yeah. One other metaphor that really works for me is an idea of it being a vehicle to connect me to God.
A vehicle.
Because
that's
then
perfect.
Then the fallibility of leaders can actually help my growth. Like in that case, it's not even an impediment. It's actually helpful.
It's kind of comforting that they're human too. And that,
yes,
you know,
and it forces you to stretch and, you know, in a way that you wouldn't be forced to if church always felt easy.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So but I'm my heart is with people who feel like they go to church and only hear about scaffolding. You know, I can imagine like how exclusive it would feel if the lessons and the talks are so much about scaffolding that it feels like at least that very specific part of the scaffolding is not very applicable.
Right.
I can imagine that that just causes unfathomable pain for people who
And I think that's our job. That's our job, and to try to communicate that it's bigger than that, and that God loves all his children, not just the 15 million that happen to be members of this church, and that it will all make sense to us at some point. But that's not to say the scaffolding is unimportant. You can't build this building without the scaffolding. That's why the metaphor is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying, because, you know, there's so many people who like have gone through a horrendous divorce and now their family just seems to be falling apart, or kids have just gone off the rails. And I think eternity is the answer to that. I mean, there's just such a long time. We just have no idea how this is really going to work. You know,
yeah.
I mean, we just have these little formulas that we're working with, you know, as far as the church goes and righteousness and so on. I just think that love for the Savior is what is going to determine whether or not where we get and what, you know, what happens in the other world. Because as even if we have children that are, you feel like are failing right now, I just think the Lord knows your heart.
Yeah.
And somehow that scaffolding is going to work.
Well, that's what President Ballard said in that talk that you're referencing
right.
a year ago,
right.
that the Lord looks on the desires of our heart, and there will be time for all those desires to be fulfilled. Can't you almost hear President Hinckley's voice, which we all miss, saying, it'll all work out in the end, and if it doesn't, it isn't the end.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's incomprehensible. Like the time is incomprehensible. The love is incomprehensible.
Right.
You know,
right.
And when we're in fear, I think we are always making those things much smaller. Shorter
that's
time,
exactly
less love.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exaltation is such a big word, you know, and you just don't know how you're going to get there. But he did say, and I have a quote here, brothers and sisters, more than half of the adults in the church today are widowed, divorced, or not married. And some wonder about their opportunities and their place in God's plan in the church. And then he just goes on to say, you have your place. You love the Savior, and he knows your heart, and he will get you where you need to be.
I love that. And I appreciate that, because I don't want anyone to walk away having heard about this book and feeling even a bigger weight to create this family that they want, you know. And I think but I also hear what you're saying, that there is a de-emphasis happening that is totally unrelated to what's out of our control. You know,
there are things that are out
of our control, and we can't change that. But there are things that are that we can control that are causing a lot of destabilization within family. So,
and that sets a good context, I think, Aubrey. And let's. I think we did this on the last time I was just here alone. Let's declare this a guilt-free zone. All parents have done the best they can with what they have at the time. And we're just all trying. We're all fellow strugglers. We're all trying to get better. I think what we can say, and you know, I don't want to overstep here, but I think given our context of the gospel, the single greatest existential threat to the Lord's plan is the decline of families across the world, because that is what undermines the eternity of building towards his kingdom.
And going back to the guilt, I mean, we say things so often that we have no ideas, just piling people on with guilt.
Right.
Even our leaders, you know, President McKay, no success can compensate for failure in the home. And people like, oh, I've failed. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I can never make up for it.
I can never make up for it. And I think, gosh, we start every speech now with this whole thing about it, get rid of the guilt, because, you know, we can just feel people saying, well, we could try this. You could try this. Oh, I should have done that. I should have done that. Why didn't I do that differently? I think that's so destructive. If we can just remember to stay positive and know that we're doing the best we can. I mean, life, people say life's short. Life is long. A lot happens to us in life. And also eternity is longer, way longer. There's just so much time to make this all work out.
Yeah. I like this, the energy of it being more of a heart commitment, that it's less about these very specific to-dos throughout your life, whether or not you have kids right now, you know, it's more about a heart commitment to connection. And that feels very reachable and doable, and it feels like the right, like good energy for wherever you are.
And knowing that you're a child of heavenly parents and all that is just so comforting.
Yeah.
You said that really well. It comes from our heart. And that leads to something that's not a current quote, but basically the scriptural quote that our book, the title of the book is based on, The Turning. And by the way, this scripture, which we're all so familiar with, we usually identify it in Malachi because it's the last verses of the entire Old Testament. But it also occurs in the New Testament, in the DNC, in the Pearl of Great Price. It occurs in all of our standard works, and we all know it well. And the hearts of the fathers must turn to the children, mm-hmm. and the children's to the fathers. And then these unbelievably sort of the most harsh wording in all of scriptures, lest the whole earth be cursed, or lest another place, in one of the others, lest the whole earth be wasted. What could that mean? Well, because God's plan is to bring about this immortal, everlasting, interconnected envelope within envelope families. And if that doesn't happen, what was the point
right.
of mortality? It's wasted. It's cursed. And so that turning, and I, you know, remember that it's both directions, Aubrey. Turn the hearts of the children to the fathers. So we always think of temple work and genealogy and family search and so on. But the other direction, turning the heart of the parents to the children, that's where the real magic comes and the real connection.
Do you want to talk about, you mentioned in the book, tipping points, things that are, that to you were signals that we are de-emphasizing the importance of these family bonds?
We grew up, and I think you being much younger, I grew up in a time when our assumption was that, you know, family-centered sort of people are the majority, and those who are really not even interested are the outliers.
Hmm.
And the tipping point comes when the majority turns into a minority and vice versa. So we talk about several things here, and we're familiar with a lot of these, and it's even true in the church. There are more single adults than married adults. In most Western countries, nearly as many children, if not more, are born out of wedlock as in. So that's a huge tipping point. We talk a lot about how a majority of marriages in many places end in divorce. Although that's changing because you hear, well, now the statistics on divorce are going down. Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful.
You're married,
wait a second.
Married.
It's because no one's getting married. And by the way, that's the progression I think we have to be concerned about, that 30 years ago, we used to worry about the divorce rate. 10 or 15 years ago, we started saying, that's not the problem. It's cohabitation. People just aren't marrying at all. Now we've taken another step, which is chosen singleness. People with no interest, not only in marriage, but even in cohabitation. Cities like Stockholm, 60% of the legal domiciles are inhabited by as one single person.
And I think in Japan, the women have decided that culturally they're required to stay home and take care of their children if they're going to have children. And they were well-educated and they want to use their education. And they're like, nope, no kids for me. I'm not doing it.
So these tipping points go on and on. More than half of Hispanic children in the U.S. are raised without a father. Among African Americans, it's 70%. 70% without a father in the home. Here's the macro. For the first time, here's where it tipped. In 2014, it's now 7 years ago, 8 years ago, more than one half the nations of the earth had a birth rate that was lower than replacement value.
Wow.
So they're losing their workforces, and it's you need 2.1 as a birth rate per woman to maintain the same level of population. In some places, it's below one.
In Singapore, they're paying women $10,000 during the pandemic to have a baby.
Wow.
Because the replacement value is 2.14 and they're at 1.1 or something.
So, okay, let's talk about that for a second, because this is interesting to me. And the same with the statistic in Japan. You know, in some ways, I could see how these statistics are signaling maybe like a really important like pendulum swing into a healthier place. You know, these women, it sounds like, were a little bit oppressed. Like they were literally not allowed to use their education. And so are we seeing this a shift that could maybe signal that there's some sort of like grasp for equality that is really important and necessary? And You know,
good like yeah. No, point. That's the balance we have to good strive point. For. Because yeah. if it's the pendulum, it's the perfect example. If it swings too far, and you have a country that's not producing enough population to even maintain its workforce, at the same time that more and more people are living older and older. You have this inverted pyramid with lots of people up here and no one to take care of them down here. And it's terrible. Yet it's driven by a good impulse, which is we need women to be able to be liberated and do what they need to do and exert their talents.
I liked this part when you kind of touch on this in the book, and I thought this was really important, that you're not making a case for us to go back in time, you know, right. and create the marriages of the 50s.
No.
Like you really paint this
that
beautiful
was a bad
picture.
Time, the 50s,
yeah, like
in a lot
yeah,
of
it
ways.
Feels like we maybe yeah. overcorrected
right.
and rejected marriage altogether. But the picture that you paint is a really beautiful idea of a more egalitarian relationship. And
yeah.
and so I appreciated that you know, maybe we're back on another edge and this
yeah.
isn't healthy either, but I appreciated that the goal is health, not like retrenchment into some, you know, old values.
No, exactly.
You know, right.
We have a chance to move to a new frontier. Whenever
yeah.
someone confronts us, Aubrey, and says, hey, families are just going to hell in a handbasket. We're doomed. We love to say, hey, let us just tell you our personal experience. Yes, there are some data that suggests less marriage and more cohabitation and people not having children and so on. But we believe the best families in history are happening today mm-hmm. with equal partnerships between a man and a woman and with a shared sort of responsibility for family that just didn't exist. You
wow.
don't want to go back to the 50s. I mean, we watch our sons and even our oldest grandkids who are married now. Those dads are so involved with those kids.
Yeah.
I mean, they put me to shame. I changed a diaper once in a while, but I was not. We were products
so much,
of the 50s in a way. We had a division
yeah.
of responsibility. Took us a while to create the partnership we have now.
Well,
yeah,
if you think about your parents, and your parents were our parents' generation, I mean, if we think about our parents,
yeah.
I mean, they loved each other and they did a great job, but the partnership was so different. It was just so different. And
you
now,
would not define those as good marriages today.
I wouldn't.
You could look
yeah.
into those families, you'd say, that's not
them,
an
yeah.
equal
yeah.
marriage.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And but there is a feeling about marriage for this next generation now that is just so fleeting. You know, just try it out
yeah.
and see. In fact, I was at Trader Joe's 4 or 5 years ago now.
I love this story.
And this checkout girl, you know, they always try to be chatty, and I love it. And so she said, what are you doing tonight for fun? And I said, we are actually celebrating our anniversary. She said, oh, great. How long have you been married? I said, 45 years. And she said, did you mean to be married that long? I mean, what a question. And it just floored
yeah.
me because, you know, they just have no idea. They're just kind of going in and see if it works and then just go on, you know.
Yeah.
But did you mean to be married
yeah.
that long? Oh, yeah, I'm in it for the long run. I said, I'm in it. But it is just not in their mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. The culture really has shifted. Yeah. I want to make sure that we're naming that. Obviously, this is a conversation about generalities, and there are certainly
right,
people
right.
who are, I remember in college, Elder Oaks coming and giving a talk about how this was the same talk where he got upset with everyone about not dating and only hanging out. But he also said, you know, I'm a general authority. I speak to the general audience.
Right.
And if you're an exception, don't write me a letter. Just yeah. like know that you're an exception and you're the only one who can
right.
decide if you're an exception. And so I feel like that's really important. Like maybe that's part of why this is hard to talk about, because, you know, we're so, I think my generation especially, we're so aware of the exceptions.
Right.
And we want to make sure that we are not marginalizing people by having the conversations. And I feel like it's healthy to just name that, like, there are exceptions, period. And only the exceptions know if they're exceptions. And we're talking about something else that is really important. And it's still important, even if there are exceptions. You know?
That's why I wanted to put it into that long-term sort of context at the first, because I'd go even further, Aubrey. We're all exceptions. There's no sort of one size fits all. There's no sort of one ideal family. There's no sort of one sequence. I should do this and then this and then this and then this. And the minute we start idealizing one over the other, people begin to feel marginalized.
What? That's such a good point. Yeah,
it is. And I think, we went to a play in New York the 1st of December. It was called A Jagged Little Pill, about a really dysfunctional family.
And it's about Alanis Morissette and her music.
Right. And so at the first, his mother's writing her Christmas letter, and she says, "I've decided that there are no more happy families, except in orange juice commercials and in Utah."
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know if you noticed, Governor Cox actually used that in his State of the State address.
I didn't know what
he said. We're going to make a stand for families. And we actually think that was a compliment in that Broadway show.
And there are a magnificent number of fabulous families and partnerships and so on. But there are also some real concerns of people that are marginalized. And we have a daughter in Arizona who's a Relief Society president right now. And they're just lots of trouble.
I love that, thinking of it like that. Like, what if there's not an ideal? Like, what if there's not an ideal for your family?
Right.
Like, only your family can be ideal for your family. And so the scaffolding is there to be useful and helpful.
Right.
But you're not trying to recreate anything.
Yeah. And you're not envying or some other. I mean, that's one of the big problems is comparison. Isn't that the truth? And we talked a little about this in the last interview we did, Aubrey, about how prone we are in the church to compare and to feel guilt and to sort of think, well, why? We go to church and everyone looks their best, right? Yeah. And we imagine that their home isn't as chaotic as ours. Or if you're a single, you imagine that, oh, wouldn't it be so wonderful if I was someone else, and so on. I want to bring it back to the commitment thing. And here's a favorite quote we have from David Brooks, who I know you like to read as well in the New York Times. But this really captures it, I think. People, because sometimes the battle is between the desire to commit and feel in our hearts these connections, which we all have, and this desire for freedom and the absence of anything that would limit my options and so on that we hear so much in the world. And he said, people are not better off when they are given maximum personal freedom to do whatever they want. They're better off when they're enshrouded in commitments that transcend personal choice, commitments to family, to God, to craft, and to country.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Isn't that the greatest?
And sometimes we feel the weight of these commitments. Yet they're what keep us grounded. They're what make life worth living. And they take away this selfishness that we're all sort of inflicted with if we don't have some way to mitigate it.
Yeah. So I loved your really concrete ideas for how to do the commitment, you know, because at some point in the book, I was like, I don't know. We're all just thinking about this wrong. Like, what actionable thing is there to do to have a healthier family? And then you really get into it toward the end of the book. And I'd love to get through some of those concrete ideas. And if I can, I want to make sure we get to this one. So I'll give you one to start. And then if you can give us a bunch. But I really loved your this section about communication traditions. And you were kind of talking about in the context of commitment to your children. Like, this is a really active way that you can open up more connection to your kids. And one of them was talking about happy and sads at bedtime, and then active listening and family dinners and, you know, things that all intuitively, as soon as you hear it, you think, that like energizes my family. Like, I do feel more connected when I do these very specific things. But I'd love for either of you to talk about what that looked like for you as parents of young kids. Like, was that your family ritual at bedtime?
One thing to roll it into that, Aubrey, because again, the biggest part of this book, The Turning, is about the fact that we're slipping away in so many ways and how the culture around us doesn't help us with our families as much as we wish it did, and as much as it did a few generations ago. And this will lead right into your question. The goal for those of us that have children living in our homes at the current time needs to be to create a culture within our family that is actually stronger than the peer culture, the media culture, the social media culture, the merchandising and advertising culture. There's all these cultures swirling around us that tend to what? Undermine our commitment, to push us to want more and more freedom and more materialism and more maximization of our selfish desires. And they're just givens. They're just there. And our kids face them every day. And the peer culture is the strongest of all those for our kids. And so how do we create a little culture? And again, be careful of guilt here, because we all wish we could do more. And we felt so inadequate so many times. And we watch our children now raising our grandchildren. And their job's harder than ours. It gets harder all the time because these other cultures proliferate. And so let's answer your question. But in the context of, we're trying to create a family
that
culture.
That is so cool. Yeah, that's such a succinct way to put it. Yeah. That's your goal.
That's the goal.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's got to be stronger than those other cultures.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think, oh, how can I get the kids away from this and this and this and this? Just make your family – this sounds easy. Make your family a stronger culture than their culture. And so they can recognize it. And it starts with communication. And thank you for this list of questions, because I do think that we had some of the best communications at bedtime when we were saying, what was your happiest thing today? And what was your saddest thing? And then, oh, I'm sorry about that. You know, it kind of leads to talking. And then the dinner table, we had a ball at dinner table with our kids. And I know that it got so that there's so much soccer and so much, you know, basketball and music lessons and all that stuff that it gets really hard. But we really tried at least 3 times a week to really have a dinner table discussion. And we did some fun things. We had them do the question game, you know, what's your best question that you come up with and so on. We had them do speeches. We had them give 1 minute speeches, and we taught them how to do it. You know, you start out with something interesting, then you have 1 minute to tell about your thing, and then you close it up. And it's astonishing what kids can do. And they remember doing that, and they're doing it with their kids, because it's a great way to communicate. And we have a child that is an introvert, and it was harder for him, but he stood up there and did it, and it was pretty amazing.
We used to call it, I haven't thought of this for a long time, but we would say now, the schools are going to teach them the 3 R's, right? Reading, writing, and arithmetic. That's good. Let's hope they do. We want to teach the other 3 R's, which are relationships, responsibility, and right brain learning. And the right brain, I mean, the schools are trying to get them all to give one answer. It's convergent learning. What's the answer? And if you get it right, you get an A on the test. We would rather have them say, wait, are there other answers? Wait, was that even the right question? Maybe we should have asked this. And so we give them a topic. What's the best question you can think of on that topic? And they would think about the best question. And then they'd go research it after, because it was their question, you know.
But probably the most important communication we had with them was like after we saw a movie together, or when we watched a TV show together, instead of just turn that junk off, say, wait a minute, what's happening there? What do you think about that? This is what we think about. What do you think? And you can not entirely influence, but help them think through those hard things.
Yeah.
And then your culture does become stronger than their culture.
Yeah, because your goal is not to tell them what to do. Your goal is to teach them how to have discernment so they can make their own choices. And boy, we're you know, as a dictatorial sort of authoritarian culture, we're too anxious to say, this is right and this is wrong and this is what you should do and I know better than you, instead of to lead them to try to make some of their own conclusions.
Or have them say, you know, say, what did you think of that? And then hold your breath.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. And then they're like, I thought that was horrible. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't give you the lecture.
I love that, because that's my temptation, right? To tell them what they should think.
Right.
But I'm sure that I know what they should think, you know, and I think if I just give them all the right answers, then they'll be able to have all the right answers. But I can feel intuitively that like the more important thing is for them to get really in touch with that internal compass and learn to recognize how they feel and what the spirit is telling them. And that totally looks like holding my breath. That is like,
that is exactly
yes,
biting like your that tongue,
right?
Biting your
it just
tongue
always looks
bit.
Like holding your breath. Yeah.
And by the way, the best ideas on communicating with your children, getting back to the thing that no two families are the same and so on. The best ideas will not come to you when you're reading a parenting book or when you're listening to some expert. The best ideas will come to you in prayer because you are, I mean, I love to think of prayer in our context as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Who are we? We're the temporary parents. We're the brother or sister who happened to come to earth 30 years before this person who could have been our parent if the birth order had been different. And we're praying to the only real father and we're saying, Heavenly Father, help me with this brother or sister of mine who's little and who I don't understand, and help me know what is needed and how to communicate and so on. Can there be a more direct prayer than an earthly parent to a heavenly parent saying, you know everything, I know so little, please help me?
Yeah.
That's a powerful prayer.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And answers come. And take notes on those prayers.
Yeah.
A couple of other little things before we get to the end that I think have made a huge difference with our family. And one is traditions. And it sounds silly, but, you know, having traditions, we decided to do birthday traditions because we had so many kids and we needed to, you know, honor them at least one day a year. And they've come back to be such a joy to us now because Richard's tradition is jumping in the leaves. And his birthday is October 28th.
So each person has their own
tradition. Each person has their own tradition.
You can't have too many
traditions. Yeah.
Traditions give this identity and this feeling.
Yes.
In fact, I'll just real quickly on mine since you mentioned it. We'd been jumping in the leaves on my birthday ever since our little firstborn was 2 years old. And so it had gone on for all these years. And we came to 1 year when our three oldest all left the same year. Two were on missions, the oldest two daughters, one in Bulgaria, one in Romania, which is poignant to think of today. And our son was in his freshman year at BYU. So I'm thinking, oh, my birthday, and I don't have my three oldest. I'm feeling a little bit sad. I go to the mailbox. I open it. There's three cards in there. I'm like, they all remembered. I can't wait to see what these cards are. I opened the first one from our oldest daughter with a Bulgarian stamp on it. It's not a card. It's a leaf.
Aww.
The leaf falls out.
Aww.
It's got a post-it note on it. I wish I'd taken a picture or saved this note, but I memorized it. She said, "Dear Dad, this is a Bulgarian leaf. I honored your tradition."
Aww.
And then in a little P.S., "Dad, don't forget, even though I'm far away, I'm still part of our family." And my heart just melted because all these little things we do, whether it's how you decorate the Christmas tree or what you do on Thanksgiving or what you do on Sunday, they're the glue that holds your – they give
they
that identity.
They are the glue.
Yeah.
What's your tradition? Can I ask you what yours is?
Let me just tell you one daughter because it's lasted longer than mine. Mine's a picnic, but hers was floating her cake. We decided no matter where we go, we're going to float her
cake. It was a Tasha Tudor
book. It came from a Tasha Tudor children's book. And honestly, it has
I don't understand.
So
I'm a cake decorator. I don't know what you're talking about.
We get a cake, and then we find a body of water to float it
in. A big pan or something.
We were at a castle, a Hever castle in England. When the kids were like, it's their birthday. What are we going to do? And they ran to the closest door and got a little cake, and we rigged up a thing.
There was a moat around the castle.
And when the kids left for missions, they said, I floated a cupcake in the bathtub for you today.
Oh my gosh, I
mean, you know, it
that.
Just comes back to you. It's so beautiful.
So this traditions was the next one I wanted to ask you about. So I'm so glad you went there. But my question is just like, how do you think of these? I remember when our first two kids were really little, I remember like having like feeling anxious about like, we need traditions.
We
like, we're trying all this random stuff that's not a tradition. It's just, you know, like doing any of those things the first time is just weird.
We let our kids choose their own.
It's true.
Some of them are really lame. Yeah, one of our sons, he goes bowling on his birthday.
But my mother was a bowler, and now we have twins that were born on her birthday. So now they're doing bowling on their birthday.
That's so
connecting. I do think that pulls the family together as much as anything. I mean,
some evolve. Some of them, our tradition on Thanksgiving was watch football all day and eat way too much, you know. And so we actually sat down one day and said, we need a new thing. So we ended up getting these rolls of paper and seeing how well the turkey was cooking, mm-hmm. how many thankful things we could write. And every year we set a new record, you know, and we're over 1,000 now.
Wow.
And so on. But it honestly doesn't matter what
they
are.
It doesn't matter.
As long as
bowling's not as exciting as floating the cake.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
But the last one that I want to mention before we close is how important it is to establish a family narrative so that mm-hmm. your kids know where they came from. You know, we've just been through Roots Tech. It was fabulous. But these stories that we're telling our children are so important to their little souls to know where they came from.
Yeah.
Whose blood is in their veins. And I have a mother who's just astonishing. She grew up on a farm with 10 kids.
But our kids never knew her.
And her kids, a couple of them,
the older kids, yeah.
But she was magnificent. And they went through such hard times. And then the Spanish, when she was 15, with the 10 kids, Spanish influenza came through Star Valley. And her mother died within 2 days. The father was the bishop, invited people into their parlor to recover on these cots. And she was helping him. And then she got it.
Oh, my gosh.
And died within 2 days. And then their 2.5-year-old died the next week. And then 4 days later, their 9-month-old died. And she went through such hard times, but she left a quote for us that all of our children have memorized, and I've got to read it to get it exactly right. She said, telling about samples of hard things that happened in your life. Now, that was a sample of many, many nearly impossible things that we did all the time. But when you master the seemingly impossible, it does something for you that fits into your very character for a lifetime and makes the next impossible thing that much easier.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I just love that. And everyone has memorized it. And that yesterday, our son, who's starting a new business, said, we use this for our business model yesterday because this is impossible what we're doing, but we're going to do it. We're going to get through it. And all of them have used this. I just think having those little bits of family narrative, your dad died early.
I was just going to say, that's the part in the church that we sometimes shortchange a little bit. We're very interested in the dates and getting the temple work done and having the records up to date and so on. It's the stories that really matter.
Yeah.
And having these stories and telling them, we know a lot of couples that we've worked with on this where their kids would rather have an ancestor story than a book read to them because they can connect it. And it starts giving this sense of resiliency and identity
and
that kids need so badly.
If they could do that, I can do that. Yeah.
It's like, you know, I saw one time, we have a family tree at the place where we have our family reunion. And each of the kids, the grandkids, have a little limb and it connects into their parents. That connects into us. We're the trunk of the tree. And then it goes down. 4 grandparents, 8. And we're lucky enough to have found pictures for all 16 great-great-grandparents. They're stern, you know how those old pictures where they couldn't smile. But we've tried to find at least one story for each of those. And some of them are silly little stories, but the kids remember them. And this one time it came through to me because I came into the room where this tree was and our little 8-year-old had just heard a story and he put his finger, he didn't know I was there, on his picture. And he went back down through his parents, down to the trunk and down to this. It was your mom. The story that he'd just been told. And he said out loud, Aubrey, and this really got to me. He said, I'm 1/8 from you. He had figured that. 1/8 of the blood that flows in my veins came from you. I just heard this story about. Wow. Think what that does for a child.
Well, these family narratives are really.
And it also just feels like a great seedbed for more tradition. You know, like you said, with bowling and recipes and like it's just so ripe for connecting, you know, roots and
branches. What we said earlier about creating this culture in your family that's stronger than the outer culture.
Yeah.
You don't have to start from scratch. There's already a culture flowing in.
And if you're grandparents and you've never done anything like that before, it's not too late. You can start. I mean, it really is fun to
so
see
easy
that.
Now
it's okay. I mean, do what you can from here.
And you know, and especially post-pandemic, it feels like we kind of, in some ways, we have like this clean slate. Like we're reestablishing what it looks like together.
Yeah.
And
people are reshaping, not only in the church, people are reshaping their families, and it's just a healthy thing. In fact, I want to turn just for a minute to optimism, because so much of this book is, you know, we're turning away from families and what are we going to do? But we try to end the book, and I want to end this too a little bit with some real optimism. I think the pendulum really is swinging back. I think people are, I mean, we see it in the people we speak to. We see it in the involvement of fathers. We see it in the optics. I mean, not to embarrass you, Aubrey, but you and Tim are great. You're a partnership. It's wonderful to see you.
So
every
fun.
Podcast we listen to, you're doing this together, and there's this synergy between the two of you. We see that more and more among the brethren in the church. The Bednars often speak together. The Uchtdorfs do. Our friends, the Claytons, like to stand at the pulpit together and give it. Not that everyone should. Not that everyone, you know, there's not one norm, but you see far more presence of women in General Conference and in other places. And I think this beautiful third level, not the 50s, but also not the gratification and self-appointedness of the entitlement age, but this new emergence, which combines the best of both, the commitment of the earlier times, but also the freedom and the equality and the beauty. I think we're really on a trajectory. Yeah. And I'll even go a step further. I think that this is dangerous, but I will predict to you that you'll see that continued movement in the church. I mean, we're not calling the mission president and his wife. We're calling them mission leaders, you know?
Yeah.
We're getting to this point where it's better. And I think we're going to see missionary work turn more toward families because, you know, the greatest
wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah. The greatest self-perceived need in the world is help with that. If you do a list of self-perceived needs, a new church is at the bottom on polls, but help with my family.
Yeah.
And here's these missionaries who represent a culture that has a divorce rate of fourth the national average, if you're taking the temple married couples, and a college graduation rate of double. I mean, these are things we should, you know, emphasize.
Don't you
more.
Feel yeah. that?
I think we'll see it in missionary work.
It really is.
I
amazing.
Think we'll see it in our curriculum, more and more family-oriented things.
Yeah.
It's great.
And just to bring the whole thing back around, I just, this idea of a family culture is so delicious to me. And and it also just kind of helps put the scaffolding in perspective that what if the scaffolding is all meant to just help you create a family culture?
Right.
And so, you know, we're doing family home evenings and prayer and scripture study and going to, you know, we have a Sabbath that's sort of prescriptive, but you know, if all of that is in an effort to create this strong family culture, how suddenly all of those things feel delightful and less, you know, heavy.
Exactly.
And even to go a step further, Aubrey, if you saw a little thing on the scaffolding that was wrong or one of the pieces of bamboo had slipped or something, would you suddenly say, I've got to go get some new scaffolding because this isn't perfect, you know?
Yeah.
Say to yourself, wait a second, it's the gospel, number one, as well as the church. And the gospel gives us the whole story, which allows us to see where we fit in it. And the church helps us. It's a support mechanism. When we speak to parents outside the church, one of the things we say at the end every time is go find a support mechanism. No matter how good you are, you can't raise kids successfully in this world without some support. We'd like to recommend that support be a church. But if not, find a community, find a club, find something that'll help you. Scaffolding, that's what you need.
Yeah, I love it. Linda, final word? Do you want to wrap this up for us?
You know, I've loved this conversation, Aubrey, and I'm sorry that Tim was out today. But you really have been a wonderful example to so many people in the church, and not only in doing this, but in your partnership, which you can feel through the microphone. We do appreciate that about you. And we know that there are just so many wonderful families out there just doing their best because they love Jesus, because they have such a heart for teaching that to their children. And you can't go wrong. If you have that in your heart, you can't go wrong.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all of your work. It's been decades now of just finding ways to strengthen families. And we're personally just so grateful.
grateful to you. Thank you.
Well, it's what matters. And by the way, the state of Utah is doing good, too. The governor's committed to a new department of children and parents in state government. So we're going in a good direction.
Yeah, it's great.
Wow.
Thanks so much for listening, and we really hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Richard and Linda Iyer. A huge thanks again to both of them for coming on. And as always, if Faith Matters content is resonating with you and you get a chance, we'd love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen on. It definitely helps get the word out about Faith Matters, and we really appreciate your support. Thanks again for listening, and as always, you can check out more at faithmatters.org.